So yeah, it's great to be back. So I'm going to tell you about these work in these few papers from last year and one follow-up hopefully to come. So my collaborators are Kara Farnsworth, who's a former postdoc at Case Western and is now in Geneva. Diego Hoffman, Austin Joyce, Greg Mattis, we're all people in Amsterdam. Austin is now at U Chicago, and Greg Mattis is a postdoc at Cornell. So the motivating question behind all this is this idea, which has been around for a while, which is it possible that gravity, in particular, maybe in the very early universe, could be in some kind of different phase than the one we know? So the phase of gravity we know is some normal phase where you have a massless graviton, a long-range force. So this is analogous in gauge theory to where you have a Coulomb phase, where you have a massless photon and a long-range force. But we know in gauge theories there are other possible phases. In particular, there's a Higgs phase where there's no longer a massless photon. And there's a confining phase where there's also no more massless photon. Is there any other phase of gravity that's possible that's maybe analogous to this that maybe could be influential in the early universe? And if so, is there any kind of model-independent way that we can get a handle on these phases? So this is the underlying question, and I'm going to be looking at some properties of gravity in the very long distance, low energy limit to hopefully get some handles on things that could tell us about these phases. And I'll get back to this phase question at the very end. Okay, so the first starting point is this idea that we have of quantum field theory as a renormalization group flow. So one way of defining even a quantum field theory is to say that it's a renormalization group flow that takes you from some UV theory at very small distances, and as you change scales and get very larger, it's supposed to flow to some different theory at very large distances. So at the concrete level in quantum field theory, we have local operators, and we compute correlation functions of local operators. And the statement of this RG flow is that if you look at very short distances, you bring the points of the correlator very close together. They should approach some scale invariant form like this, which with some scaling weight delta UV. And then if you pull the points apart in the intermediate regime, it can do all sorts of things. But then at very long distances, it should again approach a scale invariant form with some possibly different scaling dimension delta IR. By definition, these endpoints are scale invariant, so they are theories which are invariant under scale transformations. So a scale transformation is just where you stretch out everything. And here's the standard form of a scaling transformation acting on a local field where you have some scaling weight delta. What we find in actual examples is that when you have this scale invariance, you also tend to have full conformal invariance. So conformal invariance involves additional transformations beyond just scale transformations, and these are the special conformal transformations. These are transformations that distort things with in not just a scaling, but in a way that preserves angles preserves all angles between two vectors. And these extra transformations are known as the special conformal transformations, and acting on local fields, they take this form here. So there's a long-standing question in quantum field theory of does scale invariance always imply conformal invariance? And this has been proven in two dimensions for normal quantum field theories, things that are unitary and have a stress tensor and obey the usual properties of a conformal field theory. In dimensions greater than two, there's been a lot of work, but it hasn't yet been fully proven. One of the reasons it hasn't been fully proven is that it's false. There's actually counterexamples if I talk about free theories in higher dimensions. So electromagnetism is a counterexample in higher dimensions. So here's just the free theory of electromagnetism. Maxwell, F mu nu, field strength squared is the action. And we've written it here in D dimensions. So if I look at a standard scale transformation, this is automatically scale invariant in any dimension if you give the field its proper scaling weight. So this is always true of free fields. You can give them a scaling weight such that it'll be scale invariant. That's always trivial. What's non-trivial is the special conformal transformation. So if you do a special conformal transformation of the action, what you find is that it varies into something that's proportional to d minus 4. So in d equals 4, this is special conformal invariant. But away from d equals 4, it's not. And you can confirm this by computing correlation functions of gauge invariant local operators. So the basic gauge invariant local operator in electromagnetism is the field strength F mu nu. So you compute its correlators. And you'll find that in d equals 4, it takes a structure that's fixed by conformal symmetry. But away from d equals 4, it does not have that conformally invariant structure. So this is, if you like, it's a counterexample, but it's a free theory. So some people don't consider this as a true counterexample.
So here, no improvement, right?
That's right. Yeah, you can see all this in flat space without worrying about improvements or anything. Okay, so let's ask the same RG flow question about quantum gravity now. So quantum gravity is not supposed to be a true quantum field theory. In particular, you're not supposed to even have local operators. But you are supposed to have other observables, like an S matrix, that you can talk about an RG flow of. So we should have a similar picture like this, where in the UV, we have some UV theory. And then in the IR, we have some other IR theory. In the UV, this is where people who struggle with quantum gravity are worrying about. This is the UV theory is where all the mysteries of quantum gravity and singularities and so on are becoming important. On the other hand, the IR theory, this should be another fixed point where we should know everything, because we think we know everything about gravity at low energies. We think we understand gravity at long distances. In particular, we know what the low energy effective field theory for gravity is coupled to matter. It should be just the Einstein-Hilbert action, maybe with higher derivative corrections that are suppressed by the masses of the matter that you've coupled and integrated out, and so on. So this, there should be some fixed point theory here in the IR that we can study. And if you ask, what is that fixed point theory? So you're looking at energies that are now, you're going all the way to the IR fixed point, looking at energies much, much longer than any of the Compton wavelengths of the particles that you've integrated out. And as you go to very, very long distances, all the interactions coming from Einstein-Hilbert are going away because they're irrelevant. And so what you're left with at the true fixed point is just the linearized theory of gravity, the Fierce-Pauli theory, which is written here. So H mu nu here is just the metric linearized around flat space. And this is the free action for linearized gravity, which propagates a massless spin 2 particle. So this has a gauge symmetry, analogous to the Maxwell gauge symmetry, which is just linearized diffeomorphisms. It's also manifestly scale invariant. If you give H mu nu its proper scaling weight, it's scale invariant, as it must be, since it's a fixed point. And now you can ask the same question about special conformal transformations. So if you vary this under a special conformal transformation, you'll find the variation is proportional to something with a d minus 2 out front. So it would seem that this is not conformally invariant in any dimension except 2. In dimension 2, this whole action is actually trivial. It's a total derivative. So gravity is just not dynamical in d equals 2. So we'll forget about that case. So this would seem to say that there's no special conformal symmetry in any dimension in which gravity is interesting. We'll see in a bit that this is not true, that there actually is secretly a conformal symmetry in d equals 4. Okay, let's ask now about the local operators. So we know that in full quantum gravity, we're not supposed to have true local operators. But in linearized gravity, we do. In linearized gravity, we have the linearized Weyl tensor. So this is a gauge invariant operator at the linear level. And it's the analog of the Maxwell field strength. It's the basic operator, which is non-zero on shell. So we don't have to worry about the full Riemann tensor. We don't have to worry about the traces, because those are all zero on shell. So the actual non-trivial off-shell information is all carried by the linearized Weyl tensor. So that's this here. So it has the index symmetries of the Riemann tensor, two pairs of anti-symmetric indices. And it's written as two derivatives of the gauge field of the linearized metric H mu nu, and this P here is just a projection operator that gives you all the right symmetries and tracelessness that the Weyl tensor is supposed to have. So this satisfies equations of motion that are analogous to the Maxwell's equations, so it's conserved, and it satisfies a Bianchi identity. And this is, like I said, the basic local operators. All other local operators are just made out of products of this thing and derivatives of this thing. Okay, so as we mentioned, in D equals 2, this Lagrangian is trivial. It's a total derivative. In D equals 3, there is no independent Weyl tensor. So in D equals 3, this theory has no local operators at all. That's the statement that gravity is topological in three dimensions. There's no local degrees of freedom. So I'm going to consider only D greater than or equal to 4. Okay, so we can see several things about this as a field theory just from this statement that the Weyl operator is the basic local operator. So it has this weight here, d over 2 plus 1. The first thing we can see immediately is that this theory has no stress tensor. A stress tensor should be a symmetric tensor operator that has a weight delta equal d. And there's no way to make a symmetric tensor out of W that has a weight of D. You can't make it out of products of W because the weight would be too large. You can't make it out of derivatives of W because of these equation of motion. So this theory simply has no stress tensor. So then you should ask, well, how do you measure energy and momentum and so on in a theory of gravity? So we'll see how that works later on. Another thing is that there's no marginal or relevant operators that are scalars that you can add to this theory. So there's no way to make a scalar out of derivatives of the Weyl tensor. And there's no, and if you multiply more than one of them, you'll get a dimension that's too large to be marginal or relevant. So all the operators in this theory are irrelevant. So what that means is that this theory of linear gravity, it cannot be the UV fixed point of a theory. You can't say that some theory approaches linearized gravity in the UV and then gets deformed by an irrelevant operator and flows to something else in the IR. This usual picture doesn't work for linearized gravity. So it can only be the IR limit of something, and indeed it is. It's the IR limit of gravity. Okay, so let's look at correlation functions now of this Weyl tensor operator. So to compute these, we have to gauge fix the action to deal with this linearized diffeomorphism invariance. So we do the usual Fadeyev-Popov prescription of fixing the gauge symmetry. And just like in ENM, since this is a linear theory, all the ghosts decouple. And what we get is this gauge fixed theory that depends on some gauge fixing parameters. So in gauge theory, you usually have one gauge fixing parameter. And here it turns out there's two different gauge fixing parameters. So there's a two parameter family of Lorentz invariant gauges you can choose. So that's what these C1 and C2s are. And of course, the correlators you compute of gauge invariant operators are independent of this choice of these two gauge fixing parameters. There's one subtlety that will come up, is that there's one choice, C2 equals 2, which is actually not allowed as a gauge fixing parameter because it fails to completely fix the gauge. If I choose C2 equals 2 here, there's a residual gauge symmetry that looks like two derivatives of a scalar. And so it fails to completely fix the gauge. The propagator is not invertible. So we just have to steer clear of this choice, C2 equals 2. That subtlety is going to become important in four dimensions. OK, so let's first consider the case where the dimension is greater than 4. When d is greater than 4, there's a convenient choice of these gauge fixing parameters, which is this here. And you can see already that when d equals 4, C2 is going to coincide with this not allowed value of C2 equals 2. If we make this choice and then decompose our graviton into a traceless part and a trace, the action now takes this form. So this is now the gauge fixed action with this choice and with this decomposition. So H tilde is some traceless symmetric tensor and phi is this scalar trace. This, as an action, is now conformally invariant. If you do a conformal transformation on this, it will be invariant. So these traceless and trace parts you can think of as conformal fields that transform in the usual way with this weight.
Hey, Kurt, can I stop you and just check my understanding about something? So, D equals 4, there's no gauge freedom in your ice cream. It's only D greater than 5.
There's always gauge freedom, so even in D equals 4, because that's coming just from the coordinate invariance of the higher of the full nonlinear theory.
Now I want to just check against my definition maybe of what that is. So we do cosmological perturbation theory. We say H mu nu is, there's no gauge for them to change things. So what's
right. Yeah, because when we're doing cosmology, when we take the H mu nu, we're kind of taking the transverse traceless part of H mu nu. And that doesn't have gauge symmetry. But that's, of course, a non-local decomposition. So the H mu nu we use in cosmology isn't a true local operator.
Can I also help you here? Just go back to where we are at now. So you started from linear theory, just based on the Wald tensor, and you're adding terms and then looking at them.
Yeah, we've just gauge-fixed the linear theory. So we've added gauge-fixing terms in order to compute things. Okay, so here's what the correlators look like in this gauge-fixed linear theory. So the gauge-fixed action was conformally invariant, and so the correlators are guaranteed to take their conformally invariant form. So conformal symmetry is strong enough that it fixes all two-point functions up to an overall constant of tensors of any spin. So these tensor structures you see here are just structures that are fixed by conformal symmetry. And then there's some coefficients out front that are not fixed by conformal symmetry, but you can compute them from the action, and that's what these are here. So it would seem now that this is a conformal field theory, because these correlators are conformally invariant, but of course it's not the original theory, because I'm not looking here at the gauge invariant operators. I'm looking at this gauge fixed field H tilde and its trace phi. When I'm looking at this H tilde here, it violates the unitarity bound that's present in all conformal field theories for operators of various spins. So this tells us that this is actually a non-unitary theory. But we're not worried because this is not actually a gauge invariant operator. So if you compute the true gauge invariant operators, the Weil tensor operator, so this is the basic two-point function of two Weil tensors, this is now gauge invariant. But this now takes a form which is not of a primary field in a conformal field theory. This takes the form of a derivative of some primary field. So that's what we call a descendant field in a conformal field theory. So it takes this correlator takes the form of some descendant field. You can check that it satisfies all the appropriate conservation conditions coming from the equations of motion of the Weil tensor. So the picture we have is this. If I consider this gauge fixed action itself as a CFT, so I include the non-gauge invariant operator, such as H tilde, what we have is a CFT, which is non-unitary. But now if I look at only the subset of that, which is the gauge invariant observables, those are the Weil tensors, those are the observables of the original theory that I'm actually interested in, that is no longer a conformal field theory, but it forms a unitary sector of this larger conformal field theory. And this unitary sector is only scale invariant. It doesn't have the full conformal invariance.
Why is actually you say it's not conformal invariant? Okay, so you can treat this W as a descendant and they're correlated in a part covariant in the appropriate way under conformal transformations. So.
Yeah, they're not primary fields.
They're not primary.
That's right. So, and they can't be a primary of anything because they're not the derivative of any gauge invariant operator.
Yeah, no, that I understand. But yeah, what does it mean? Because when you have conformal. I see. So basically, if you have conformal theory, you can prove that they're primary, right? Just by building like top.
Yeah.
And here's something really down. So we're going to calibrate down in this kind of standard. There is no generator, basically, the generator conformal transformation is not an operator in the Hilbert space.
Exactly, that's right, exactly. The primary is simply not in the Hilbert space, yeah.
So you don't
doesn't get a CFT. Yeah. I think it's just a scalar.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so what confuses me that, you know, the correlation function, they are still in very covariant in this appropriate way under the formal transformation. Yeah, well, as a sentence, as a correlation function of the sentence, not as a primaries.
Right.
So in this way, there is a symmetry, right?
Right, it's just that the primary. Exactly, yeah. The primary is simply not gauge invariant, so it's when you cut it out of the Hilbert space, it's not there.
Yeah. And another question, could you do the same with electrodynamics?
Yep, the same story goes through for ENM as well. That's right. Okay, so now something different happens in D equals 4. So in D equals 4, we cannot reach this gauge choice that we use to form this picture. We can make any other choice, and we can compute the correlator of these W operators. And when we do this, we miraculously find that in D equals 4, the conformal correlator takes the appropriate conformally invariant form for a tensor of this symmetry type. And to get it into this form, it requires using dimension-dependent identities that work only for D equals 4. And you can show that the equations of motion and so on all hold. So what this tells us is that in D equals 4, the linearized gravity actually is a conformal field theory, that this W is actually a conformal primary, even though the action itself was not conformally invariant. Okay, so this is kind of like a hidden conformal symmetry, if you like. It's there at the level of the gauge invariant operators, but it's not realized in the action in the usual way. And in fact, we shouldn't even have expected it to be realized in the action in the usual way, because H mu nu, it's a gauge field. It's not a true local field in the theory. There's no reason necessarily to expect that conformal symmetry should act on that in the usual way. In ENM, it does act in the usual way because the electromagnetic action is itself made out of gauge invariant operators. It's F mu nu squared, whereas the gravitational action is not just the square of the Weyl tensor. It's something else. Okay, so the conclusion is that the fixed point of the IR fixed point of quantum gravity has conformal symmetry, but only in 4 dimensions. And the same also goes through for all the higher spins you can show. Okay, so now I want to change gears and start and study these so-called one-form generalized symmetries.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What can you build the charges out of local currents here? I mean, the charges of conformals in the parameters.
No, right, because there's no stress tensor, so you can't build them as integrals of the stress tensor like you usually do.
Right, so it's a
year. Yeah, and I'm gonna get to that later. They actually show up as one-form symmetries.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Another formula can from us really, but it seems that we have one way of saying that the theory is conformally invariant by looking at the action and saying that the action has a conformal symmetry. And the other way is like looking at the correlators that you did now.
Yeah.
It seems that for D plus 4, it doesn't agree.
Yeah.
Agree for other dimensions.
Yeah, so, right. So in other dimensions, it agrees. In D equals 4, it doesn't seem to agree because the action isn't invariant in the usual way under conformal symmetry. What probably happens is that it's invariant in some non-local way. There's some non-local way of acting the conformal symmetry on H mu nu, which becomes local when acting on the curvature. But we haven't figured out what that non-local action is. But that's the expectation.
Maybe a related question. You know, all this formula involving all the indices in the previous page, is there a way to rewrite all of that in terms of differential forms?
Probably, but they'd be like biforms because
yeah.
You've got symmetric indices.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll ask him.
Okay, so I want to switch gears now and talk about one-form generalized symmetries. So when we talk about usual symmetries, usual global symmetries, these are now called zero-form symmetries. So in a usual symmetry, we have some conserved current, J mu, and then we make a charge by integrating that conserved current over a space-like surface. So that's a codimension 1 surface in space-time. And then we say that that charge is conserved because I'm free to move that surface in time. That's the statement that this surface is a topological operator. Its value doesn't depend on where the surface is, and that's what we usually call a conserved charge. So these one-form symmetries are generalizations of this, where I now have a current that has two indices, an antisymmetric J mu nu thing, which is conserved when I act on one of its indices on shell like this. And we make charges now by integrating this two current, or its dual, over some codimension two surface in the spacetime. So the most familiar example of this is Gauss's law in electromagnetism. To measure the charge of something, I integrate f mu nu around a codimension two surface, the Gaussian surface, and then that picks up the charge of anything that's in between. So the objects which are charged under these one-form symmetries in four dimensions are line operators. So this line Q here, you can think of as a world line, say, of a charged particle, and I surround it by this operator made out of the integral of J, and it measures the charge that's on this line, just like a Gaussian surface surrounding the world line of a charged particle measuring its charge. And then the conservation of this current J tells you that this surface I put around to measure the charge is topological, so I can deform the surface all I like, and it still picks out the charge as long as it surrounds the surface. Okay, so the familiar example of this is ENM. So in ENM, in four dimensions, we have two of these one-form symmetries. So one of them is the electric symmetry, where the two-form current is just f mu nu, the field strength itself. So the charge we get is we integrate the dual of f mu nu over a two-sphere, and we pick up the electric charges of things within that two-sphere. That's the Gaussian surface. And there's also a basic charged solution in the theory, which is just the Coulomb potential. If I have a point charge at the origin, it generates a Coulomb potential, and then this picks up the charge. There's another two-form symmetry, which is just the dual of F. So the dual tensor is also conserved because of the Bianchi identity. So this is the magnetic two-form current. And if we integrate this over a two-surface, we pick up magnetic charge. And this has a charge solution as well, which is the famous Dirac monopole. So this one is peculiar because you can't write it solely in terms of the gauge potential in a way that's everywhere regular. You have to use different patches that are connected with a gauge transformation and so on. But once you do that, the field strength F is regular everywhere away from the monopole itself. And then when you integrate it, you pick up its monopole charge. Okay, so we want to ask the same question now in linearized gravity. Are there these one-form symmetries? And the answer is yes, there's a bunch of them. So we first have to find these two-form currents. So in linearized gravity, the basic gauge invariant operator was this Weyl operator, and we want to make a two-form conserved current out of it. So we have to soak up these extra two indices with some object, which is going to be analogous to a Killing tensor. So going back to ordinary symmetries for a second, you know that if you have a stress tensor, T mu nu, if I want to measure the energy and the momentum, you have to take that stress tensor and then you contract one of its indices with a Killing vector, and then what's left is an index that gives you the conserved charge that tells you about energy if that Killing vector is in the time direction, or momentum if that Killing vector is in the space direction, and so on. So this is analogous. We have these objects which are Killing-like tensor objects, but here they carry two antisymmetric indices. So if we want this two-form current now to be conserved, so we act a d mu on here, the W is conserved. So if we act a d mu, we'll only get this dxc part here, and this has to be zero if we want conservation. So the condition that this has to satisfy becomes this. So this is a Killing-like equation that this xi has to satisfy. So this is known as a generalized conformal Killing equation. So there's this trace part that we subtract because the Weyl tensor is traceless. So this is an equation that says the mixed symmetry part of this derivative has to be zero. It's just a generalization of the usual conformal Killing equation. And you can write down the general solution to this. It turns out there's a finite number of solutions, just like there are a finite number of killing vectors. And the solutions can be parametrized in this way. They're called killing Yano tensors. So here, X is a embedding of our spacetime into a spacetime of two higher dimensions. This is the Dirac cone formalism. But you can just take these X's to be, these big X's to be defined like this. And then this K is some constant tensor in D plus two dimensions, which carries three antisymmetric indices. So for every choice of this constant tensor K, when you plug in here, you'll get a solution to this equation. And the statement is that this is the most general such solution. Okay, so we want to look at what these solutions are. So if I take this D plus two dimensional K, and I split it up back into ordinary D dimensions, so we'll get some fully antisymmetric three index thing. We'll get two pairs of two index things. And we'll get a one index thing from all the various components. So we get these four different tensors in four dimensions that parameterize our solutions. And if you count all the number, all the components of these various tensors, you'll find that in four dimensions, there's 20 of them. So there's 20 different charges that one can write down, 20 different one-form symmetries.
Okay, this all came because you had the W Y tensor have the
it's conserved, so it satisfies this conservation equation. That was essential for these to be conserved charges. Yeah, so that it was essential that that was conserved so that these would be conserved charges. Okay, so you can also write down dual currents where you use the dual of the Weyl tensor, where you dualize just with respect to the first two indices. These will give you dual charges. Okay, so what do these various charges mean? So if we look at these various components, let's first look at this component which is parameterized by a vector in, we'll just stick with four dimensions, so vector in four dimensions. So these four components turn out to correspond physically to just the energy and momentum. And if you ask what is the charged solution, the solution that carries these charges that's analogous to the point charge in electromagnetism, that solution is just the linearized Schwarzschild metric. So if I write down the linearized Schwarzschild metric, plug this in for the Killing-Yano tensor, and then form this conserved two current thing, and then use the Gaussian surface to measure the charge, what I'll pick up is the mass and momentum for this Schwarzschild metric. So this is how energy momentum is being measured in this theory by these one-form charges. If I look at this three-index thing among the Killing-Yano solutions, in four dimensions, that's dual to another vector. What this picks up is a quantity that you might call dual energy momentum. So it is to energy and momentum what the monopole is to ordinary charge. It's like a magnetic dual of energy and momentum. And the charged solution that carries that is the linearized Taub-Nut metric. So it carries a kind of magnetic dual to mass and momentum. If I look at this two-component things, there's two of them. One of them carries what's the ordinary angular momentum. So that's the charge solution there is the Kerr metric. And then there's another one which carries a dual version of angular momentum, which goes by the name of the C metric. So all of these charges are they're manifestly gauge invariant because they're made out of integrals of the Weyl tensor. So this is unlike the usual ADM charges in gravity. So usually when we construct ADM charges, these are some kinds of surface integrals which are not actually integrals of gauge invariant objects. But here they are. Here they're just standard types of things, just like you have in E and M. These charge solutions, so everything I've said here is about the linearized theory, but these charge solutions all exist fully nonlinear as solutions in full general relativity. So that's one sign that the structure might not be so silly to consider. Okay, so when we have all these symmetries and these conserved currents and so on, we should also study anomalies because these are handles that you have in quantum field theory that are non-perturbative. So I first want to just go through a simple example of what anomaly is in quantum field theory in the way that I want to think about it. So the simplest example of a quantum field theory anomaly that I know about is, suppose that we have a theory that's in two dimensions and that it's a conformal field theory. And suppose that there's an operator in this conformal field theory which is a vector operator. So it's a spin one operator and it has a weight of one. Just from this information, you can show that the conformal algebra, the conformal symmetry, implies that this operator is conserved and that it satisfies this kind of dual conservation condition. So it's kind of like the Maxwell tensor. It's conserved and satisfies like a Bianchi identity, but in two dimensions. If I look at the two-point function of two of these spin one operators, at separated points, the structure is completely fixed by conformal symmetry, as it is for all two-point functions at separated points in a conformal field theory. So the only thing that's not fixed is the coefficient, which I've just set to 1 here for simplicity. You can show that these conservation conditions are then exactly satisfied here at these separated points.
Kurt, can I ask a question about the previous slide?
Previous slide?
This linearized Taubnut example, the idea there that analogously to the direct monopole that you can cover the space-time with two asymptotically flat metrics?
That's exactly right. Yes, you need two H mu nus to cover the two patches, and then they overlap with a diffeomorphism.
And what goes wrong when you?
Yeah, so there's a Dirac string-like thing that you can't get rid of. Yeah. But the Weyl tensor is regular everywhere.
Final question. Just for some of us, what about order symmetries of the linear
vector? Sorry, say again?
What are order symmetries? Is that the one form? Are there other symmetries?
There may be. I think these one forms are all the ones I know about. But there may be higher form things as well. People haven't studied that.
One more question. I know that if I have a conserved current in upstream dimension in CFT, then the scaling dimension is b minus 1.
Uh-huh.
You are saying for d equal to 2, if I know it's spin 1 and delta is 1, then it's necessarily a conserved current?
Yeah, it's the same here. Delta equals 1 is d minus 1.
Yeah, but I'm asking about the direction of the logic. If I know it's a conserved current, I know its scaling dimension is b minus 1, but now if I know it has spin 1, and delta being d minus 1, not necessarily know this is a conserved current.
Yeah, in a CFT, if you have a spin 1 operator, it's conserved only at specific values, and that value is d minus 1. So it does go both ways.
I'm asking if I know an operator has spin 1, scaling dimension being d minus 1, isn't necessarily a
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so this correlator is completely fixed by the conformal symmetry, and it satisfies these conservation conditions. But here, we're only talking about strictly separated points, where x here is not equal to 0. But we know that in quantum field theory, these correlators are supposed to be distributions. So they're supposed to be things which, if I talk about a local measurement, I'm supposed to be using some. When you do a local measurement, it's not always exact. There's some like width to your detector or whatever. And so these correlators are supposed to be things where if I integrate it over a smooth function, I get an answer. So they're supposed to be distributions. And so in particular, you have to say what's going on at coincident points to fully define the theory and how to integrate it over smooth functions and so on. So we have to ask what's going on at these coincident points, and the easiest way to do that is in Fourier space. So if I go to momentum space, here's what that two-point function looks like. So what we're going to do is add this arbitrary piece here, which is the only conformally invariant piece, which is a contact term. So it's non-zero only at the coincident points. So in momentum space, you can identify contact terms by things which are analytic in the momenta, so things which are powers of the momenta, because these are things which, when you Fourier transform them, they will turn into delta functions and derivatives of delta functions and so on. So this piece, this first piece, is the non-analytic part. So this is what Fourier transforms into the stuff at separated points. But then this part here is analytic in the momentum, so it goes like p to the 0. So if I Fourier transform this, this turns into a delta function. So this is parametrizing what's going on at coincident points. So we've added this arbitrary term here with this arbitrary coefficient c to parametrize our ignorance about what's going on at the coincident points. Okay, so now we can ask about these conservation conditions. So in Fourier space, these are our two conservation conditions. And when we act them on here, what we see is, in general, a failure. So for general values of c, it's not conserved everywhere. It fails to be conserved, but it fails to be conserved by an amount that's local in position space. So it's analytic in the momentum. So the failure of conservation is happening only at coincident points, a delta function of in position space. The anomaly is a statement that there's no choice of this c. So this c is what we call a counterterm. There's no choice of c for which I can set both of these to 0. I can set c equal to 0 and make it dual conserved, but then it won't be conserved. Or I can set c equal to minus 2 pi and make it conserved, but then it won't be dual conserved. There's no choice of this contact term that preserves both of these conditions at coincident points. So that's the anomaly. So this is a way of stating what anomaly is that doesn't depend on anything about path integrals or measures or perturbation theory or anything. So a way that that people often phrase this is in terms of an effective action. So a convenient way to calculate correlators is to write down a generating functional. So I write down something like this, where I couple an external source A to the conserved current, and then I get a generating functional that's a function of this A, and then I can compute correlators by taking functional derivatives with respect to A. And the way that these conservation conditions show up is as gauge invariances of this generating functional. So if I think about ordinary conservation of this current, if I have a gauge invariance where delta A transforms as a derivative of a scalar, the usual kind of Maxwell gauge invariance, if I imagine doing this in the effective action, if I have a derivative of lambda here, I can integrate by parts the derivative and it will hit J and vanish by the conservation. So this statement here is that if I have a W which is gauge invariant, that's what corresponds to a conserved current, a current which is conserved everywhere, including these coincident points. Dual conservation, it would look like a gauge symmetry like this, where I have an anti-symmetric gauge parameter. So the statement that we have an anomaly is the statement that we cannot write an effective action that has both of these gauge symmetries at the same time. So when we write down the effective action, the way we allow for these arbitrary contact terms is to have local terms in the effective action. So here's the most general local term compatible with the dimensions and so on, where we have this arbitrary constant c that corresponds to the constant big C that we had in the correlator before. So when we add this, the statement is that there's no way to choose this c such that we have both of these gauge symmetries at the same time. So the best you can do is have one of the gauge symmetries, and then the other will not be a symmetry, and the failure of the other one will then be completely fixed, and that's what we call the anomaly equation. Okay, so here's a simple example of this. Let's just consider a free scalar field. So a free scalar field has a current, which is just d mu of phi. And this is a conserved current, because if I take d mu of this, I just get box of phi, which is 0 on the equations of motion. And it's also dually conserved, just because derivatives are antisymmetric parts of derivatives commute. Okay, so the free scalar has these conditions that we're talking about. So now I can try to couple this to our external gauge field to form generating functional. So here's the coupling of A to the conserved current. And here's the arbitrary contact term with some arbitrary constant C. So now I can just ask, is this thing gauge invariant under the two different types of gauge symmetry corresponding to conservation and dual conservation? And we have to keep in mind that the scalar field in the action can also vary and include all possible variations of that. So if we do the variation under the conservations gauge symmetry, we get something that varies like this. So to be conserved, we'd have to choose c equal to minus 1. And under dual conservation, we get something like this. So for this to be satisfied, we'd have to have c equal to 0. So there's no choice of c for which both hold at the same time. So the best we can do is choose 1. So if I want the current to be conserved, I would choose c equals minus 1. And then this equation here would be completely fixed. I would have chosen c, and there'd be some fixed failure of the conservation of the dual conservation of J, and that's what we'd call the anomaly equation. So there's an interesting theorem, which is kind of like, it's like a Goldstone theorem, but it works off these anomalies rather than on broken symmetries, which the usual Goldstone theorem has. So we can invert the logic of what we just talked about. Suppose that I give you these conserved currents. Suppose I tell you that I have a theory that has a current J that satisfies this type of anomaly equation. So it's conserved, and it fails to be dual conserved by some amount that I tell you. And that's all I tell you about the theory. From this, it turns out we can prove that the theory has a massless spin zero particle. So if I look now at the general point of the two-point function, so now not assuming conformal symmetry or anything like that, I just assume Lorentz invariance. The general point of a two-point function, the general form of a two-point function looks like this. There's these two arbitrary scalar functions and these two possible tensor structures. So if I now impose these relations, so if I impose conservation everywhere, then it fixes these two coefficients relative to each other. And if I now impose the dual non-conservation that comes from this anomaly equation, I get this, and it fixes what the functional form of the rest of this correlator is. So in fact, the form of this correlator is completely fixed by this anomaly equation. And now you can do a spectral decomposition of this two-point function and learn that there's a delta function in the spectral decomposition, basically because of this 1 over p squared pole that tells you that there's a massless scalar particle in the spectrum. Okay, so now we can do the same thing for linearized gravity. So now our basic conserved operator is the Weyl tensor. So if we ask, and we have these two conservation conditions on the Weyl tensor. It has this conservation and it has this dual type of conservation. So we should ask if there is an anomaly between these two types of conservations. So we write down the most general possible form of the correlator by adding these possible contact terms. So these etas are just the flat space background metric. This is a schematic form for what the correlator looks like. There's all sorts of indices everywhere here. But basically, you have a non-local part that comes from the fixed separated point structure of the correlator. But then there's two possible contact terms compatible with the dimensions and so on, which are parameterized by these two constants, C1 and C2. So these are the local terms that parameterize our ignorance about what's going on at coincident points. So now we try to impose our two conservation conditions, the ordinary conservation and the dual conservation. And we get some failure, which, as it must be, is local in position space, polynomial in momenta. And we get some coefficients out front that depend on these C1 and C2. And just like in the scalar example, there's no choice of C1 and C2 for which these are both 0. So there's an anomaly between these two conservation conditions. So we have to make a choice. So we can impose conservation, for example, that will fix these two C's, and then we'll get a failure of the dual conservation, which is completely fixed and gives us an anomaly equation. So here's what it looks like from the point of view of the effective action. So to study the effective action, we would take our linearized Weyl operator and couple it to some background gauge field, which has the same symmetries as the Weyl tensor. So this is now some background gauge field with 4 indices, which the same symmetries as Weyl, so traceless and the same index symmetries. So here's the coupling we write down. The first line is the original massless gravity action. Second line is the coupling to the Weyl tensor. There's the two derivatives of H are the Weyl tensor. And then here are the two possible local contact terms that we can write down with the two arbitrary coefficients, C1 and C2. So now conservation would tell us that there has to be a gauge symmetry with respect to this background gauge field, which looks like this. It's made out of this derivative of some three-index operator with this mixed symmetry index structure. And you also have to remember that the graviton can transform in the most general way. So if we impose this conservation condition, we find that everything is fixed. So the two C's are completely fixed, and this B was an arbitrary coefficient in how the graviton transforms. That's also completely fixed. Notice there's a 1 over D minus 4 here. Something weird is going to happen in four dimensions. So when we make this choice, the dual conservation now fails, and we get an anomaly equation under transformations of gauge transformations corresponding to this dual conservation. So here, this is some five-index gauge parameter. So we get some anomaly equation that's now completely fixed. So we can make now a similar argument of a Goldstone-like theorem. So if we assume this anomaly equation, so we assume we have some theory that has a conserved current with the index structure of Riemann, and it has this anomaly between its conservation conditions, we can now use this to completely fix the two-point function, just like we did in the scalar case. And then doing a spectral decomposition, this will tell you that there's a massless spin 2 in the spectrum. So from this point of view, you can think of the massless graviton as a kind of Goldstone for this type of operator and anomaly equation.
So Kurt, do I remember correctly from the beginning of the talk that the Weyl tensor and the dual Weyl tensor are both conserved by consequence of the Bianchi identities?
Yes.
And so this anomaly is saying there's some anomaly in the Bianchi identity itself?
Right. So the anomaly is between the conservation and the dual conservation. So you can think of that as an anomaly between conservation of Weyl and conservation of dual Weyl.
But those two conservations both are an exact consequence in the fully nonlinear theory of the Bianchi identity.
Yeah, they're just the linearized version of Bianchi.
And so you're saying that somehow in the IR limit of gravity, Bianchi is breaking?
Yes, but it's breaking in a way that's only happening at coincident points. And presumably it's happening in the full theory also. It's
violation only happening right?
Right, that's another way of saying that it only happens at coincident points.
Sorry.
in the original theory. Yeah, so in the nonlinear theory, there aren't even local operators, so we can't even use this language. So something else has to take its place. Okay, so I'm going to skip over there's something else interesting happens in D equals 4. There's a generalization of the trace anomaly that happens. So ask me about that afterwards. Okay, so back to this question about the different phases that originally motivated this. So if we go back to electromagnetism, there are these three different phases that we know of for gauge theories. There's this normal phase, there's this superconducting phase, and there's this confining phase. It's also interesting that in the standard model, we have three gauge groups, and each one is in one of these different phases. Electromagnetism is in one, is in the normal phase, the electroweak theory is in the spontaneously broken phase, and QCD is in the confining phase. So the normal phase, so we can classify these essentially by what's happening with these one-form symmetries. So in E&M, we have these two one-form symmetries. We have the electric one-form symmetry and the magnetic one-form symmetry. And the charged objects are Wilson lines with the ordinary symmetry. So those are just charged particle world lines. And for the magnetic symmetry, the charged objects are T'Hooft lines. These are just magnetic monopole world lines. And the statement is that in the normal phase of E&M, if I have ordinary charged matter that's coupled to the theory, then this symmetry is explicitly broken. But the U1 magnetic symmetry is spontaneously broken. And this Goldstone you can think of, so the photon you can think of as the Goldstone for the spontaneous breaking of the magnetic one-form symmetry. And the order parameter is this T'Hooft line. It gets a kind of perimeter law scaling in its expectation value. So you don't see these phases by local operators the way you see with ordinary symmetry breaking. You see the phases with these one-form symmetries. The superconducting phase is another phase. This is where we have spontaneously broken gauge symmetry. But we shouldn't think in terms of spontaneously broken gauge symmetry because we know that gauge symmetry is fake. It's just a redundancy. So we shouldn't really think about spontaneously breaking it. So the invariant way to think about it is with these one-form symmetries. So if I want to have a superconductor, you have to have charged matter that condenses. So this U1 electric symmetry is explicitly broken. But now the one-form magnetic symmetry is unbroken, and we get for the order parameters tells us that the magnetic, the Tu-Hoff loop gets this area scaling. So the scaling of these charged line operators tells you which phase you're in. For the confining phase, this one-form symmetry is explicitly broken by monopoles or something. Like people talk about monopole condensation. This confining phase you're supposed to be able to think of as a dual to the superconducting phase, whereas the one-form symmetry is unbroken, and we get an area loss for the Wilson loop, which tells you about confinement. Yeah.
Yeah, I think in this place specifically is appropriate to mention the perimeter law.
Very nice. Okay, so we can imagine a similar scenario for gravity. So gravity, as we know in the real world, would seem to be in a normal phase. We have these one-form symmetries now that we can talk about, where we have Wilson lines and Tu-Hoff lines, so corresponding to ordinary energy momentum and this dual energy momentum of the Taub-Nut solution. So the usual situation we're in is where we have a massless graviton. So this we have ordinary matter. So this one symmetry, this electric-like symmetry is explicitly broken, but the magnetic symmetry should be spontaneously broken, analogous to the ENM phase. So we should be able to think of the graviton as the goldstone for the spontaneous breaking of this magnetic symmetry, and we should be able to see that from some kind of perimeter law for a Tu-Hoff loop. So if you could somehow make a loop solution out of the Taub-Nut solution, you should be able to calculate this and get a perimeter law. That's something I'd like to do. So now the question, is there some kind of other phase of gravity? Is there a Higgs-like phase where diff symmetry, if you like, is spontaneously broken? So that would presumably be diagnosed by having instead an area law for this Tu-Hoff loop. And so there have been various proposals for what this phase might be. There's this paper of Vaffa from 2020 where he proposes that there's this topological theory of gravity that Witten came up with in four dimensions that he proposes as this topological phase that could be present in the early universe. This is one way that you might be able to get a handle on whether that's really true, if you could calculate what the scaling of a Tu-Hoff-like loop in that theory is.
Is that due to the condensation or anything?
Yeah, so that's a good question. What could possibly condense to give you the Higgs phase? Nobody knows. And you can also speculate about a confining phase, which would be dual to this.
Sorry, isn't the idea that somehow the topological, people often talk about the idea that the topological theory has full GL4 symmetry, and then it's when you condense and have a particular metric like the Minkowski metric, or maybe a particular tetrad, that's the order parameter that condenses.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's all in the language of the gauge symmetries, which I think ultimately that's all redundancy, and we shouldn't really be talking about it in that language. We should be using the actual physical things, which are these one-form symmetries, and the true order parameters, which are these line operators. Yeah? Yeah, that's a good question too. So whether these are ultimately quantized in some way, I don't know the answer to that, but that's an interesting question, yeah. Okay, so I'll summarize. So I think, you know, when people work on quantum gravity, they're often talking about the UV and singularities and so on, but I think there's still a lot to learn about the infrared limit of gravity, the other fixed points. So I've told you about a few things that we've learned about that, this conformal symmetry, these one-form symmetries, these new anomalies between them. And one of the things about anomalies is that there are things that are supposed to be give you a handle about RG flows. If you know, there's Tohoft anomaly matching. If you know something about the anomalies at one end of an RG flow, it should tell you about the other end of the RG flow. So if we know about these anomalies in the infrared, maybe we can say something about what's going on in the UV fixed point. If there's an anomaly matching argument one can make. So the real question is that everything I've talked about is essentially for this linear theory and this strict IR limit. Can any of this be useful for saying anything beyond the fixed point or maybe the UV fixed point at the other end of the RG flow? And okay, so I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Let me just quickly announce before people fade away for questions. Kirk, are you around for dinner tonight?
Yes, and tomorrow.
We meet for speaker dinner at 6 p.m. at the bistro. Feel free to come, and everybody's invited. Covered by the cosmology seminar budget. And then I guess we'll probably also go for lunch right after Emma's meeting.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, so questions.
Yeah.
You like to think about higher modifications of gravity.
Yeah.
Can you comment on what happens when you change
things in the IR? Yeah, very nice. So yeah, I like to think about IR modifications. So modifications where you add a mass, where you give a gap to the graviton, those are in some sense trivial, because if I give a mass to the graviton, then in the strict IR limit, everything just goes away. It just becomes a trivial theory. Maybe there's some kind of topological theory left, but all the degrees of freedom go away. So in that sense, it's much more boring in the IR. Any other type of IR modification, you're going to be ruining something like Lorentz invariance, because we know that massless spin 2, if you think gravity is spin 2, the only gapless thing is this.
Could you turn around and say that if it's true that you have this anomaly argument that you have, therefore, that means that at the far infrared you cannot have a gap?
Yeah, exactly. So this is an argument that tells you why the graviton should be massless if you believe this anomaly structure.
If you break diffeomorphism very symmetry, presumably you also break local Lorentz invariance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 So if you break these gauge symmetries, you typically get a mass of some sort, or you break Lorentz invariance altogether.
Yeah, but for this anomaly matching, I know that this is also hard. It's a gold standard of some kind of anomaly, right?
Mm-hmm.
Still, we have a Higgs space for Poisson, right? For red matter. So, how these two things are reconciled?
Yeah, but there has to be something that soaks up the anomaly in the IR.
Okay.
Yeah. Some kind of topological theory, or maybe that soaks up the anomaly. Yeah. So that's right. Yeah. In principle, there could be something topological that soaks up the anomaly. Yeah.
Yeah, so you didn't actually say what the values of the anomaly
were. The values of the anomaly.
I mean, what's the magnitude? It's just like log, basically, like some units.
Yeah, and so those coefficients in the correlation function are essentially that. So you can just calculate it from the free theory. It's
right. So it's
dimensionless.
Yeah. And is that great?
Yeah, that I don't know, because that's the same essentially as the question of whether the gauge symmetry is compact or not, which we don't know. Well, in some sense, in free theory, it's I don't know if it's meaningful, right? Because like even in ENM, in the free theory, whether it's quantized or not, you have to talk about large gauge transformations and so on, that you have to know something about the structure of the gauge group to say what the quantization condition is.
Okay, I guess the way to say it, the dimension was here, what the unit is, why?
yeah, essentially.
So I tend to think of the sort of Cartan for reformulation in terms of spin connections and tetrad one forms as being a bit deeper, and then the self dual version of that, where you just take the self dual part of the spin connection as being yet a bit nicer still. Do you have a sense of what would change in this analysis if you formulated gravity that way?
I don't know. I guess I don't think of the spin connection formalism as any deeper, because you're just introducing more gauge symmetry, right? You're introducing local Lorentz symmetry explicitly, so it's like an extra Stuckelberg type gauge symmetry. It's not doing anything ultimately physical.
Okay, so maybe whether it's deeper is a matter of opinion, but do you think that the analysis would change of the anomaly structure?
No, because all this is independent of the gauge symmetry. This is all true global stuff, so it doesn't care what type of Stuckelberg or local Lorentz type stuff you introduce.
So at linear level, you can introduce arbitrarily many tensor fields with their gauge groups. On the other hand, at linear level, we know that it's almost impossible, or there are very serious obstructions to that.
Mm-hmm.
Would this analysis somehow shed light on what's happening in the line?
Yeah, that's a good question, yeah. I don't know the answer to that, but that's something I want to look at, is what exactly goes, like if you try to extend this to next order in the Einstein-Hilbert, exactly what happens, yeah.
All right, looks like that's all the questions, so let's thank Kurt again for a great talk.